Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and we've got my mother, Caroline Kilborn, with us today. Hi, Mom.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. And you are now vaccinated.
Yes, sore arm and all.
Yeah. But and we're very, very grateful that our guest today was willing to reschedule so that Mom could get her second vaccination.
Yes, I really appreciate that.
Yeah, yep. So who do we have today?
Well, today we have Jane Healy, and she is the Amazon Charts and Washington Post best-selling author of The Beantown Girls, which we interviewed her some time ago about that one, and the Saturday Evening Post Girls Club, or Saturday Evening Girls Club. When her daughters were young, she left a career in high tech to fulfill her dream of writing historical fiction about little-known women in history. It was a pastime and a passion that turned into something much more. Now she shares a home north of Boston with her husband, two daughters, and two cats. When she's not writing, she enjoys spending time with her family, traveling, running, cooking, and going to the beach. And this book is, is a page-turner for sure. It really is. It's really good.
And the title is The Secret Stealers?
The Secret Stealers, yes.
And that's because they're stealing secrets.
Yes, they are.
It's amazing. Welcome back, Jane.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be back.
Okay, so give us just a kind of what is The Secret Stealers in a nutshell?
So The Secret Stealers is based on the true stories of the women of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the precursor to the CIA in World War II. But it also pulls in some, you know, it's also based on some of the true stories of the women of the SOE, some of the British female spies, and women of the French resistance. And so the protagonist is Anna Kavanaugh. She's a widow in D.C. who's teaching French at a private school in D.C. and kind of trying to figure out what to do with the rest of her life. And, you know, there is a war going on. It's 1942. And an old family friend, General William Donovan, who was a real person in real life and is also a character in the book, recruits her because he was the founder of the OSS. And he is an old family friend, knew her father. You know, knew she had a knack for languages and was very bright and was looking for more women to join the organization. And then that takes her on a trajectory to become one of the few OSS female spies during World War II in occupied France.
Is she based on a specific real person or a number of real people?
She's based on a number of real people that I read about. Betty Lussier was one of them. Betty Lussier was one. Virginia Hall, of course, is probably one of the most famous of the OSS undercover spies. Elizabeth Dorchester was another one. She's really a composite. There's a couple other characters in the book that are based directly on real people, but Anna I kind of came up with from a few different women that I researched.
Wow. How did you find out these stories?
Well, it was interesting. I kind of keep a running file of possible future book ideas, and I can't remember exactly when I came across it, but I came across an article in the Washington Post a few years ago about these two women living in a retirement community outside of D.C. in Virginia, and they lived on the same street. One of them was in her late 80s, one was in her early 90s, and they became friends and realized that they both went overseas as spies for the OSS during the war, and they had never met each other. And they both ended up working for the CIA afterwards and had never met each other. And, you know, because a lot of these people, their work was so secretive, they didn't talk to other people within the OSS or the CIA. So they discover they have this really extraordinary background in common and become best friends very much later on in life. And so that was so intriguing to me because I had, you know, I'd heard of the women, some of the British female spies. I didn't really realize that there had been really any American female spies with the OSS in World War II.
Yeah, it's not something that's we really hear much about.
No, and part of it is because, the OSS grew very large over the course of the war, several thousand men and women. A small number of those women served overseas, about 7,500 men and women served overseas for the OSS. Most of the women who served overseas worked in the offices of the OSS. A very small percentage of the women overseas served as spies, as undercover agents. And to be honest, I don't have an exact number because it's still classified. So, but I think it's probably just in maybe the hundreds, if that.
Well, that's still a lot because, how many undercover spies can you have?
That's true. Yeah, it's anywhere from 38, which is because they had a parachute school, the OSS, and anyone going to the parachute school was definitely going undercover. So there was around 3,800 men in the parachute school and about 38 women. So it's anywhere from 38 to, a few hundred women who were undercover.
Wow. And it seems surprising that more of them didn't share their stories after the war.
Well, they had to sign, not the Official Secrets Act, that was with the SOE, but they had to sign a secret act saying that they would not discuss their job, their work to anyone outside of the OSS, including their family members. And a lot of them, even when they were retired, these two women had a hard time talking about it, even in their 80s, because they took that to heart so much. They really, they were so loyal to the organization, and they were so worried about putting anyone else in danger, that really kind of, they were indoctrinated about the secrecy of it. And that's why these stories have just kind of started to filter out, particularly over the last 10 years, probably. The OSS personnel files were not declassified until 2008, so you couldn't even read those online. Now you can find those online. Betty McIntosh, one of the older women in the article, several years ago wrote a book called Sisterhood of Spies, The Women of the OSS. It was a small press, and that was one of the books that was kind of the jumping off point for me, because she talked about her own experiences in the book, but then she interviewed several of the women who are her counterparts in the OSS and the various jobs that they did. So that really helped me realize, okay, there's a story here. I can use this as a jumping off point for my research and for a narrative arc.
Wow. Now, a large part of the story here is before your heroine actually gets to go undercover.
Yes.
Yes. And that's really interesting, too. So she's in D.C. At the beginning of fairly early on in America's involvement in World War II.
Yes.
And was it difficult to get good information about that, or was that pretty easy to research?
That was fairly easy. She had written, Elizabeth McIntosh had written a lot about her experiences and the experiences of the women working in D.C. I was able to find a fair amount of material, and I thought it was kind of fascinating just because, again, they were very discreet, but Donovan was building this organization very quickly from scratch and really kind of on the fly. America's espionage game had, we didn't really have a spy organization before the OSS. So it was really fascinating to me how quickly they had to build and adapt and hire. And so I found a fair amount. William Donovan is an extraordinary character. There's a few books about him and his life and his building of the OSS that were also enormously helpful for the part of the book that takes place in D.C.
Do you know if he actually recruited, would have actually recruited a young woman like your character?
Yes, absolutely. He put a woman in charge of recruitment, and there's a woman in the book based on her. And this woman talked about how difficult it was to recruit women for this organization because she couldn't, in the job descriptions that she put in newspapers and magazines, she couldn't really put any details about what these women would be doing because it was so secretive. And so she complained that it was hard to compete with, the WACs and the WAVES their recruitment campaigns were very flashy, and they, you know, talked about the adventures these women would have and the sleek uniforms. And she said it was very difficult to compete because until you got these women in the door, you couldn't even tell them what they would be doing. But a lot of young people, one thing I learned, a lot of young people, because the war was going on and so much was going on in D.C. and there are so many jobs, a lot of young people flocked to D.C. at that time because they were looking for, you know, they wanted to be a part of the war effort in some way. And so there was a lot of young women looking for work and found themselves working for the OSS.
I was just wondering if the resistance work that they did actually help to bring about the defeat of Germany, do you think? I mean, is that historically, is that a true thing?
I think it certainly helped. To what degree, it's hard to say. But I think it certainly helped. I will tell you that the information that they are able to obtain in the novel from the Germans that they are able to steal, that is based directly on a true story. And it really did change the trajectory of the war in some really critical ways in terms of, you know, the Allies obtained knowledge of what the Germans were building in terms of military strength and bombs and things. And so they were able to react to that in much quicker than they would have been able to if they had still been in the dark for several more months.
That was certainly important because, when you're fighting a war across an ocean, it's kind of it's difficult to realize what's going on, and you just don't know what's true and what isn't. Talk about fake news, you know, but...
No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, there was one, I wrote an article for Lit Hub about the training and about some of the different roles these women played. And, you know, for instance, one of them, she wasn't exactly an undercover agent, but she was working in Italy, and she was analyzing aerial photographs of what the Germans were building. And that was another way that the Allies obtained intelligence. They would just pore over these aerial photographs of different areas and try to figure out what was going on, what the Germans were building behind the scenes. And they were pretty successful with some of that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we have heard in recent years there's been some movies about the British women from Bletchley Circle.
Yes.
You know, the code breakers.
Yes, yeah.
And so I think there's a real fascination with the role that women played in World War II, and particularly, and you kind of an underlying theme of the Secret Stealers is the fact that your character, Anna, was very bright, very intelligent. She went to, which women's college was it?
Oh, Radcliffe.
She attended Radcliffe. Yeah, she attended Radcliffe. She graduated. She had a father who was very supportive of his daughters, but she didn't have a lot of opportunities because she married a man who everyone thought was brilliant, and she kind of got overlooked.
Yes.
And the thing that's interesting, but then Donovan wasn't overlooking her, but one of the things she learned how to do was how to appear like a dumb broad.
Yes.
So that she could be more successful as a spy.
Right. I know. Yeah.
she was fluent in French and German, which was extremely advantageous for her in her role.
Yes. Some of these women, their language abilities were pretty extraordinary, and that's what made them so valuable as spies. They spoke 2, 3, sometimes 4 languages, which is just incredible to me.
And, of course, they had to be to speak French without an English accent.
Yes.
Which, I mean, how many people can do that?
I know. It's pretty rare. My husband lived in Paris for a while, and he takes pride in the fact that when we go back to France, they can't tell where he's from. And that's what they wanted. They wanted people who could blend not only in terms of looks, which women could do more than men in occupied France, but also in language. You know, they couldn't, any sort of accent or struggle with the language would trip them up.
Mm-hmm. And of course, men, young men, healthy, wouldn't have been there. They would have been in the Army.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, and that's what, you know, Donovan went to see what the SOE was doing in terms of training spies, and learned on one of these visits to the UK of the success that the SOE was having with women in the field, particularly in the occupied zones, because of what you said, because there weren't that many men around, so women blended in easier. And so when he went back to the States, he realized that they needed to build up, you know, more women in the organization and more women in the field than before.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Jane Healy, author of The Secret Stealers. Jane, why don't you read a little bit from the opening of the book for us?
Okay, thank you. Chapter 1, June 26, 1942, Washington, D.C. My watch said it was 15 minutes before 8 in the morning, but I could already feel the oppressive D.C. humidity rising as I stood under a tree and gazed across the street at the three-story brick building with enormous white columns. I looked down at the sweaty piece of notebook paper in my hand where I had scribbled the address, checking for the fourth time to make sure I was at the right place. The East Building, 2430 East Street Northwest, across the street from the State Department. A brick building with columns. Enter through Gate 2. Ask for Alice Montgomery at the main reception desk. A large chain-link fence with barbed wire lined the perimeter of a complex that comprised four buildings. I couldn't see any signage or markers, nothing whatsoever to indicate what went on inside. For the 100th time, I questioned my decision to do this, to come and interview for a government job I didn't actually need in an organization I knew very little about. "Excuse me, can I help you?" I turned to see a young woman observing me from a few feet away. She was a couple of inches taller than me at 5'5", with pale blonde hair and wore a light blue and white striped summer dress with cap sleeves and a navy blue straw hat that flattered her heart-shaped face. I looked down at my dull plum-colored shirtwaist dress, and I wished I had gone shopping for something new to wear today. I hadn't set foot in a department store for months, since well before the funeral. "It's just that you look like you might be lost." She gave me a small smile. "Well, I think I'm in the right place, but I'm a little early for my 8 o'clock interview." I pointed at the building. "That is 2430 East Street Northwest, yes?" "I didn't see any sign." "There's no sign, but you're correct," she said. "I work there. Do you want to walk in with me? I can point you in the direction of reception when we get inside. It can be a little confusing." "Oh, thank you. I would appreciate that," I said, relieved. "I'm Anna Kavanaugh." I held out my hand. "Irene Nolan, happy to help," she answered as we crossed the street. "What kind of work do you do here?" I asked, eager to hear from someone who actually worked in the building. Irene paused before answering. "Oh, mostly research, organizing, you know." She waved her hand. I glanced at her sideways as she quickly changed the subject. "So let me guess, Wellesley grad, or maybe Smith?" "Radcliffe, actually," I said. "I graduated 4 years ago and did a postgraduate year in Paris." "Ah, well done," she said with a nod. "I adore Paris. Did you enjoy living there?" "I did," I said. "It was one of the best years of my life. Such a beautiful city. The culture and food, the people. I fell in love with all of it. I might not have come back if not for the war." "I'll bet. I'm a Vassar girl, class of 38, like you. Do you know who you're meeting with today?" "I'm supposed to ask for Alice Montgomery when I arrive, but I'm also meeting with William Donovan." Irene nodded and gave me a wide smile, clearly impressed. "Wow, Wild Bill, the legend himself, is meeting with you. Is that right?" she said. "Now that's interesting. He's so busy these days, he rarely has time to interview anyone." "He's a friend of my father's," I said. "I'm sure that's the only reason he's meeting with me in person." "How do they know each other?" she asked. "He's been pulling recruits from everywhere he can to try to build this place up fast. Business connections, social circles, family and friends." "They grew up together in Buffalo, New York," I said, not really thinking myself as a recruit and wondering what she even meant by that. No wonder he's meeting with you in person. That's much more than a casual acquaintance." I nodded. We arrived at Gate 2 and walked up the incline toward the building. Irene wasn't done with her questions. "Is your husband in the service?" she asked, glancing down at my wedding band. I felt my stomach drop as she kept talking. "Mine is. Military intelligence. which means we can discuss absolutely nothing at the dinner table except for baseball, which he obsesses over and I barely tolerate. He's a Yankees fan. She looked over at me for a response. When I got dressed that morning, I had agonized over whether or not to wear my wedding ring, as I did every morning since January 22nd, when I had first learned the news. I didn't want to make her feel uncomfortable. There was no casual way to say it, so I chose not to say it at all. He was shipped out to Hawaii after Pearl Harbor, I said. He's a Harvard Medical School graduate, and a group of them went there to help with the injured, implementing some promising new medical procedures. It wasn't a lie exactly, just an omission of the entire truth. Oh, wow, she said. Does he know you're interviewing here? No, I said, feeling my cheeks burn. I had never been a good liar. I'm sure he'll be so proud when he finds out, she said. I just gave her a small smile as we walked up the granite steps towards the main entrance. Men in uniform and smartly dressed women were hurrying by us, ready to start their day. I still had not seen one single sign declaring what government department actually resided in this building. It was so odd, but then, given the rumors in the newspapers about Donovan and this department, not entirely surprising. A dark-haired young man tipped his hat and opened the door for us, and we entered the high-ceiling main hall. It looked like any modern-day office building and had a musty, sweet and sour smell, a combination of something like floor polish and ink. Still, there was no placard listing any departments and no numbers on the few doors I could glimpse from where we were standing. Reception is down that hallway to the right. Check in with the secretary, Irene said, pointing. She reached out and shook my hand. It was so very nice to meet you, Anna. If they offer you a job here, just know it's a fascinating place to work, like nowhere else, truly. And there are more than a few young women like us, smart women. The hours are long, but it could be the type of job to keep you busy while your husband is away. Thank you, I said. If I never saw her again, I wouldn't have to feel guilty about not telling her the truth. And thank you very much for your help this morning. I appreciate it. Good luck, she said. I hope to see you soon. She turned and joined the throng of employees hurrying to their various destinations as I headed in the opposite direction.
And that is Jane Healy reading from The Secret Stealers. Now, I think we can, you had mentioned that Anna was a widow, so I don't think it's giving too much away to say that was what she didn't tell her new acquaintance.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's revealed pretty early on. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And, but she's, you know, she's not exactly a heartbroken widow.
Yes. And I'll tell you one thing that really intrigued me when I was trying to figure out her background story, I knew she was going to, she went to Radcliffe and that's where she met her future husband. And one of the things I saw, I went through some old papers, and I found a newspaper, I think it was the Boston Herald, and one of the articles was six Radcliffe women to marry Harvard men. And it was six Radcliffe seniors, and they were all marrying Harvard men. And I was like, here are these bright young women, and this is what they're being recognized for. You know, not that they've graduated from Radcliffe or, you know, are brilliant in their own right, but that they're marrying Harvard men. And so that was kind of one of the seeds of Anna's story about, like, these very bright women with not a lot of opportunities because of the time and the place.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought...
I know they used to talk about women going to college to get their MRS degree.
Right,
did you
ever
hear that when you were young, Mom?
No, I hadn't.
No?
I've heard that before. And that was apparent in more than one newspaper article, including in the Radcliffe newspaper. And, you know, senior year, there was all these celebrations and parties honoring seniors, but it was all about, a lot of the articles were about, this one's marrying a Princeton guy, this one's marrying a Dartmouth guy, you know, things like that as well. And I was like, oh, that's all, you know. I'm sure these women's stories are much richer. I'm sure they have a lot more to offer than just the fact that they're marrying, you know, an Ivy League guy.
Yeah. So, Jane, you had this idea of writing a novel about these women who are American women sent undercover into France, occupied France.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about, like, how did you actually determine the plot of the story, and did it just come through the writing, or do you plot it out ahead of time?
Well, you know what? That's a great question, because you know, the plot was definitely kind of a culmination of various stories I had read about in my research, woven together into one fictional story. But I wanted it to have the feel of a spy thriller, and having never written a spy thriller before, I wanted to get it right. And so I think one of the things about spy thrillers is that they're well-paced and well-plotted, and you know, the timelines are very clear, because those things you can't mess up in a spy novel, you know, if you want it to have that kind of intensity. So I am very much a plotter and a planner, and you know, before I really even jumped into page one, I had mapped out the entire book from beginning to end.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you do that visually, or how do you, you know, what tools do you use for that?
So I, you know, with my first novel, The Saturday Evening Girls Club, I only used Word, but I knew, like with the Beantown Girls, I had so much research, and I didn't organize my research well with the Saturday Evening Girls Club, and I'm like, oh, I have to be better organized, because it will take me less time. And so I used you might be familiar with it, a program called Scrivener. And that is a word processing program specifically for writers, you know, authors, screenwriters. And it allows you to write the manuscript, but also have all your research within that document as well. So I had multiple folders of notes and pictures and videos and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And so I had all my research in one place. I had an outline that I could it's not an actual cork board, but it's a cork board in the program that I can see every chapter by chapter. Each one's a note card. So that was one way I mapped it out. And I really map out like chapter by chapter, scene by scene, and really even in some cases event by event within the scene. Like, so it's almost,
wow.
Yeah, it's almost like the outline becomes a super rough draft, you know, and it's a total map for what needs to happen in each chapter.
So that's why the reader is right there.
I hope so.
Yeah,
I hope.
Exactly. That's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a lot of planning and, you know, and a lot of work up front, but I find that it helps me. It helps me get it down.
And you think the overall process is made more efficient that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not perfect, but it definitely helps.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we've talked to authors who do that actually physically, you know,
yes,
with the note cards and the cork boards, like you said, or they lay things out on the floor. You know, they have all these different scenes and different events, and they lay it all out and move things around. Whatever works, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, but I know a lot of author friends who do that. Where I come from, high tech, I'm like so used to screens now, and I have a big monitor at home that lets me like look at everything, you know, across a huge screen. So that's super helpful too.
Do you do anything with paper and pen?
No, not hardly. Well, the only thing I do with paper and pen is like I'm looking at my bookshelf of all the books I use for research, and I have sticky notes. I'm so superstitious. I still haven't taken them out of the books for the research. So I have sticky notes with notes on them, you know, just like so I can, like, you know, I might have a note in Scrivener about what book where, but I can grab it quick and find it. So,
wow. I've even sort of partially made the transition to making my grocery lists on the computer.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
On the website of the store.
I know. Yeah.
And that's because of COVID. Since I wasn't going into the stores, I was getting curbside pickup, so you have to order online, so that just would make the list right there.
I know. Isn't it amazing how shopping has changed this year? I don't know if I'll go back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a huge shortage of cardboard, corrugate. I don't know if you've heard about this.
Interesting.
Yeah. So in my business where we use Corrugate, the price has gone up twice already this year. It's gone up about 20%. It's scheduled for another increase because, and they're blaming it on all the online shopping.
Yeah. That. Well, I you know, we order, my husband and I both been ordering a lot from, well, as everyone in the country, right, up on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of amazed at how much cardboard they use sometimes. I'm like, is this necessary?
Oh,
you know, do we need this much?
I know. And, you know, I always wait and order group orders. I don't order one thing at a time.
Right, right.
But they ship it separately.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes they still ship it separately, no matter what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. It just seems, I mean, we have gigantic recycling bins here.
Same. Yeah.
And I can fill them up completely in 2 weeks.
Oh, easily. And, you know, we're to the point now, my husband will drive down to the city yard and put it in that recycling thing because we're like overflowing. So.
I know. I hope that the cardboard, the Corrugate really does get recycled because there's a lot of things that we're putting into recycling bins that there's no market for the recycled.
Yeah, I think
so
about that too.
Happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's another problem we'll solve another day,
right.
I guess. Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jane Healy, author of The Secret Stealers. Now, I know that The Beantown Girls was also a World War II story, although not a spy story.
Mm-hmm.
These women were, they were driving a truck.
Yes.
Or a van that served coffee for soldiers. What were they called?
They were called the Red Cross Clubmobile Girls. And they drove what looked like modern day food trucks up to the front lines of the war to serve coffee and donuts. And cigarettes.
Which is just amazing.
Amazing.
That actually happened.
Yeah, and the fact that the Red Cross was passing out free cigarettes, too. Like, what?
That, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now, was your first book also a World War II?
No, that was based on a Boston story, a group of immigrant women, Jewish and Italian immigrant women in Boston's North End at the turn of the 20th century that called themselves the Saturday Evening Girls Club.
Mm. So that was earlier then?
Yes, yeah.
Turn of the 20th.
1908,
yes.
Yep.
Okay. Wow. And will you stick, do you think, with this time frame as you know, in your next few books?
You know, I worry a little bit because there's a lot of World War II fiction out there, so that's a little bit of a concern, but I think it really comes down to, you know, and I was talking to a book group last night about this. It comes down to the story, and if I feel passionate about it, passionate enough that I'm going to spend 3 years on it or however long it takes to put a book into the world, because I find, like, I've gone down a few research rabbit holes since finishing up The Secret Stealers, and, you know, I've stalled out on a couple because I'm like, if I'm not feeling passionate and fascinated by this now, readers are not going to feel it, you know, so I have to kind of find the right story. I'm not as concerned about the time period as like a really a story that is like, you know, you just, it's like an instinct. You're like, oh, that's super interesting, and I haven't heard about it before, and hopefully other people will find it super interesting too.
You have to wonder, in how many years are people going to start writing novels about COVID? Because
it's very interesting.
It's worldwide, you know. It's not just
I think it's good. I totally agree, and I've been thinking about this a lot because I have a 14-year-old and a 17-year-old, my both daughters, and I'm like, I think the writing and the creativity that's going to come out of this time period is going to be really fascinating to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, what are the untold stories of the 20th century now?
Yes. Yeah, and there's still some out there. I'm sure there's still some about women, because I feel like we're finally in a really interesting time in fiction and nonfiction where these stories are being shared and discovered, which is amazing. Women's stories in history.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are some of these stories that you have started researching that didn't quite click for you?
Well, one of them, and it's not for lack of being an interesting time and place, but I just couldn't find my way into I couldn't figure out the narrative arc. I couldn't find my way into the story, and it was the Berlin airlift right after World War II, and what the Allies did in terms of supporting the Berliners during that time. So, that was one that I'm not saying never, but I just was, it wasn't clicking for me. So that was one.
So you'd kind of have to find a specific story of that might really grab you.
Yeah, or multiple.
In order to do
stories.
That.
Yeah,
multiple,
yeah.
And
I just wasn't feeling it. And my husband's like, I know you. Like, when you're feeling it, like, you know, you can't stop thinking and talking about it. You're just not there with this one. So, so I moved on from that, at least for now.
Yeah. And do you have another example like that?
You know, I have a couple others, but I haven't definitely decided not to write about them.
Ah, so you don't,
keep
so
those
you don't
under
want
wraps.
To reveal those.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So in The Secret Stealers, like you mentioned, some of the characters are real-life characters, including William Donovan. Do you think that if he read his portrayal of himself, would he recognize himself?
I read several books about him, and he was a really fascinating, larger-than-life character. And his organization, the men and women of the OSS, adored him. And I just hoped. I think, you know, my dad's a William Donovan fan, and he read the book, and he's like, "Yeah, I think you got him. I think you kind of captured this larger-than-life, charismatic personality. I think he's one of those people when he walked into a room." Everyone looked, you know, he was just he was an incredible leader. He was one of the most decorated officers in military history after World War I. And so, yeah, just really extraordinary man. And I hope I did him justice. I think I did.
And another character who was based on a real person was Anna's friend, Julia.
Yes.
And I don't know if we want to reveal anything more about that. It was a pleasant surprise to me when I realized who this Julia was.
Yes, and that's a nice surprise. I'd like to keep, you know, I'll be a little vague about it. But I will tell you that, you know, I think I captured that person as well. And the letters that this character, Julia, wrote are based on true letters and history and the basic trajectory of her life story is based, it's all based in fact, so.
Yes. And then there was some minor character in Paris, or a pair of minor characters who were also like, oh, wow, is that, I wonder if this was really true. So did the Dior siblings actually participate in the resistance?
Yes, well, Christian Dior worked for the House of Lalong, which was credited with saving the Paris fashion industry from the Germans. The Germans wanted to move to Berlin, but the House of Lulong, the designers at that house were credited with saving the Paris fashion industry. Christian Dior was an up-and-coming designer working for them. He didn't have his own house yet, but his sister worked for the resistance. His sister... he called her Caro. Her name was Catherine Dior. She worked for the resistance and actually ended up being imprisoned. She was captured and was sent to one of the camps. And but she at the end of the war, she got out, and he just adored her and just was so impressed with her bravery. And Miss Dior, one of his perfumes, is named after her.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and what about...
That's a cool story.
Yeah, yeah. So she was really strong woman, worked with the resistance, and the scene in the book is fictional, but that's all based in fact.
Something else I want to ask is, did John Wayne really try to apply?
He did. And, you know, I was debating a few months ago, and that scene is true. He put down his qualifications. He was good at riding horses, and he was an actor. Like, that was his qualifications. And Dunham was like, oh, you know, you're not going to fit in if I put you undercover in a small town in Italy. Like, this isn't going to work out. But it's interesting because I think he was really just wanted to do his part and was kind of fascinated with the OSS. And at the end of the war, he received an honorary, like, as an honorary employee of the OSS or something. Like, he never really served with the OSS, but I think he was so enamored with it, they gave him this kind of honorary, not degree, but, like, certification saying that he was an honorary member of the OSS.
Well, he made a lot of war movies, and, of course,
yes,
lots and lots of them made then, and he always did a good job. But I was just reading something about him, and he said he really didn't like horses, so that was kind of funny.
Yeah, and there is, like, there is some, like, you know, because people love this history, that there is some chatter among people that say that he actually did do a little bit of work for the OSS when he was filming movies overseas, and I was never able to find whether that was actually factual or not. But there was, it's possible he did a little work for them, but yeah, that whole scene where he's like, he puts that down in his qualifications, you know, goes to OSS. Yeah. But they were like, oh, I don't think you can go undercover anywhere in the world without being recognized. He was huge. Yeah.
You know, he was born in Iowa, you know.
Oh, he was. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Which is where we are.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So, Jane, there's another character who's an American socialite living in Paris under the occupation and throwing parties for the German soldiers. Were there actually Americans living there that kind of cooperated with the soldiers?
So she was a real person in real life. She was a real character in history. And, yes, there were some of the upper class, some of the, you know, some British upper class and some Americans who were already living in Paris and living very well in France stayed there. And they did, you know, turn a blind eye, you know, socialize with Nazis. Some probably sympathized with Nazis. And she was one of the ones that did often and had parties all the time. And the parties would be a mix of, you know, undercover agents and Nazis and artists and writers, all kind of in this salad of people during those times.
Well, did she know that undercover agents used her parties to mingle with the Nazis?
I think she suspected for sure. I think it was, you know, Paris was a small world unto itself during, you know, occupied Paris was a small world unto itself. So yeah, I'm sure she did suspect.
And maybe that was partly why she was doing it. That was maybe her contribution.
You would hope, but I think a lot of these people were a little bit selfish. Florence Gould, that was the one we're talking about. She was a socialite and incredibly wealthy. Her husband, I think she had an arrangement with her husband, would be in the south of France. She would be in Paris. I think she had multiple affairs, including with Germans. And, yeah, she was a real character in history.
Well, wouldn't it be interesting to find out that she was really a spy the whole time?
Yeah, it would be interesting and also be like, it would kind of be like, oh, well, that's good because, gosh.
Yeah, yeah. Like, otherwise.
You know, redeem herself. Jeez.
No kidding.
Oh, I wanted to ask a question about, it mentioned several times where they were bribing Nazi soldiers or officers. The intelligence was bribing them for different things. What made them think that those guys wouldn't turn around and tell their comrades, their Nazi comrades, that they were, you know, what the thing was, what was going on?
Well, that's an excellent question. From what I understand, I think they really scoped him out before they thought they'd be bribable. You know, it wasn't just anyone. They made sure that their marks were the right marks. But that was always a chance. That was always a risk, of course.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because if someone can be bribed to do something, they might be bribed to turn on, you know, you can't really trust them.
Right, and that did happen in history, too. I read a couple of instances where, you know, some of these guys were playing both sides, you know, against one another and making money on both sides.
Right.
Now, Jane, I see on your website that you have some events, and by the time the listeners will hear this, some of these might be over, but on April 1st, you're doing a launch party. This is April 1st, 2021. Because with, you know, with websites, interviews live a long time. So someone might be listening to this in, you know, 2026. But you're celebrating the launch by hosting a World War II themed panel with two other World War II authors, Linda Loigman.
Yes, Linda Loigman.
Best-selling author of The Wartime Sisters, and Pam Genoff, best-selling author of The Lost Girls of Paris.
Yes.
And we did do that book on Writer's Voices also. So tell us a little bit about how you got together with these two women, and what's this panel going to be like?
So we're going to – it'll be really fun. I didn't want it to be an event where it's just talking all about me. So, you know, I wanted it to be, like, more of a fun, more of a party. And so so, yeah, we're going to talk about World War II history and research and books we're reading and make it more like a fun panel thing. So, I'm really looking forward to it. That's April 1st. We've already have over 200 people signed up. It should be a really fun night. We'll take questions from the audience, all of that stuff.
And that's on Zoom, and so you can attend from anywhere.
Yes, it's on Zoom. And anyone can sign up. It's open to all. And then I have... a library-sponsored event that's also open to all on April 6th, where we'll talk about I'll talk about the history behind the story of the Secret Stealers, and all about, and I'll have slides and old pictures and some of my research and how I kind of formed the story from there.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the research. I know that a lot of research can be done online these days, but are there times when you need to actually go to the archives?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, a lot can be done online, you know, but I think that sometimes you've got to find the source materials. I think in this case, it was almost, you know, with the Beantown Girls and Saturday Evening Girls Club, it was a finite amount of research to be found, you know, because those were smaller stories. But this one, I could still be researching now because it's OSS, French Resistance, SOE. There's so much out there. And I also did actually suffer through a trip to Paris for the research.
Oh, you poor
thing. I know. In October 2019, my husband and I went, and I found a historian there with he was an expert in occupied Paris and the resistance, and I spent an entire day with him walking all over the city, looking at different landmarks, looking at different buildings, and that was invaluable. And some of the things I learned from him really helped me change the arc. It really kind of helped me shape the arc of the story. It changed the direction of the story a little bit because I learned some things from him that were so fascinating, and they had to go into the novel.
So the various locations like the hostel and the apartment and or the safe house and the clubs and so forth, are they all real locations?
They are. Yeah, most of them are. The club is, I mean, the bar, the underground bar, is based on a bar in Saint-Germain that we went to that it was very cool, like, you know, ancient building. And so I use that as kind of the the design of that bar. So that's fictional, but yes, the safe house is based on the real safe house. All of the addresses on Avenue Foch are based on the real addresses where the Germans, where the Nazis took over these homes because they were so beautiful and grand. And Sumner Jackson, the doctor who was at the American Hospital in Paris, he also lived at 11 Avenue Foch, and that's in the book as well.
I was curious about that, this hospital. How did they allow an American hospital, basically?
It was under the jurisdiction of the Red Cross, and so they were somewhat protected, and that's how they were allowed to, although as the war went on, the Germans got less tolerant, but they were somehow allowed to operate and help the POWs and help American citizens living in Paris still. There wasn't that many of them, but there were some. So, yeah, they were under the jurisdiction of the International Red Cross, so they were protected.
And the
Germans respected that.
They did. Yeah. At least as the war went on, and they started to suspect that Sumner Jackson was also, faking death certificates and hiding agents in his home and doing things like that to get people out. They grew less tolerant of him. He ended up arrested, as did his wife and son, towards the end of the war, and they ended up in the camps. And sadly, Sumner did not make it, but his wife and son made it out alive.
Well, that's good.
Yes, yeah.
Has anyone written a historical novel about him?
Not with him as the main character. There was a book, I'm looking on my shelf right now, a nonfiction book, Avenue of Spies, that really, it's about him and living on Avenue Foch with these Germans all around him and all the brave things that he did to help save American soldiers who were coming through and different people. So he was pretty amazing, and also smuggle secrets and smuggle information out of the city.
Now, Anna and Josette were working supposedly for these French industrialists, like translating things for the German at a hotel. Was that something that was really happening?
It was. There was not an Anna there, though. There was not an OSS undercover agent, but that is based on the true stories of Jeannette de Clarens Rousseau, who was she worked for the resistance. She was a young, brilliant graduate of the Sorbonne in Paris. She was Parisian. She was very angry that this was happening in her city, and she took it upon herself to start spying even before she was affiliated with any resistance network. And she got this job with the French industrialists, which allowed her to interact and work with the Germans at the Hotel Majestic on a near daily basis. And they grew to trust her, and she was able to steal all this intelligence right under their noses.
I don't know how you put this all together. I mean, it's just amazing that you could, you know, there's so many characters in here, so many people.
Thank you.
And yeah, it's just, it really is. It's like I said, the page turner. And it's a thick book, but I would say if you want to read this, give yourself some time, and because you're going to want to keep reading it.
Thank you so much.
How did you learn about the training in the UK, and did OSS agents actually go there for training?
They didn't. There were several training sites that the SOE ran in the UK. St. Albans was another one. And I know for sure that some OSS agents were trained at St. Albans. But as far as I know, I don't think any of them were at Bewley. And that's actually the way it's pronounced. I talked to a British guy who was like, no, you're pronouncing it wrong. It's Bewley. The Bewley Estate was where some of the training took place. But it was such an – if you look it up online, it's this just incredible manor and estate. And I was like, oh, that's like a really fun place to write about. So I had Anna end up at Bewley.
It does sound like a fun place. And some of them, like you mentioned, had parachute training because they parachuted in. Anna didn't have to do that.
Yes.
Fortunately.
Yeah.
But she was being trained as a wireless operator. And I think there was another book, and it might have been The Lost Girls of Paris, which was Pam's book, where the characters were some of the people going undercover were as wireless operators. This was a very, very dangerous occupation, wasn't it?
It was. Many of those wireless operators ended up being captured and killed, and it was dangerous, and it was very hard because sometimes it was like it was coded, and then it was double coded or double encrypted, and then they had to wait for they'd send the message, and then they had to wait for it for a response, and then the Germans over the course of the war got more and more sophisticated about monitoring where these wireless operators were working. Their technology grew more sophisticated. They were able to pinpoint them quicker. So it was an incredibly dangerous job.
So there was some way that they could tell that messages were being sent?
Yes, they'd go around with these trucks with antennas on top, and they could pinpoint by within like a few blocks or a block, and then they kept on getting like their technology kept on getting stronger and stronger in terms of being able to track these people down.
Wow. Why would anybody be willing to take that kind of risk? I mean, in some place in the book, one of the characters is saying, well, the life expectancy of a wireless operator is 6 weeks.
Yes, it got really grim. And, you know, I asked that too, like, would I do that? How did these women find the courage to do this? And, I read an interview with Jhené Rousseau, and she said it wasn't even a question. We were compelled. We had to do it. It was our country. We had to do these things to get it back.
So, Jane, when you're looking for the next great story, where are some of the places that you look?
Oh, gosh, anywhere and everywhere. It's nice, too, now, because people will send me newspaper articles and things like, hey, you should write about these people, you know, so that's kind of fun. But all, you know, I keep an eye out everywhere I go. I read, I did some work for the Beantown Girls and the Girls Club. The Schlesinger Library at Harvard is a research library, and it's all American women's history. So that's a good, they have an amazing website to peruse, you know, but all over the place. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm looking forward to your next story.
Yes. Thank you.
Because it's really fun to read about these women who made a difference in the history of the world.
Yes.
At a time and in a way that was, you know, they were bucking a lot of tradition and a lot of kind of rules, in a sense,
yes,
to do what they did. And these are stories that it's important to tell.
Thank you. I think so, too. And thank you so much for the kind words.
Oh, you're welcome. And we're just about out of time. Do you have any advice for somebody who wants to write historical fiction?
Well, it's so funny. The editor of my publishing company, Danielle, is always like, you know, I think writers are crazy, but I think historical fiction writers are even crazier because they have to do so much research. So you have to really love the research. You have to love that aspect of it, because even when you think you're done, you're never done, you know, until you send in the manuscript. It's an ongoing process. So I say, you know, embrace that part of it and use the history as a jumping off point.
Wonderful. And Mom, do you have some final words for us today?
Yes, this was in her book, actually, in the beginning. But Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, then at this time, said, "What is the use of living if it be not to strive for noble causes and to make this muddled world a better place for those who live in it after we are gone?"
I love that quote.
Mm-hmm. That is a great quote. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today, Jane, and highly recommend The Secret Stealers. It's a fun read, but a lot of great history in there, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you so much for having me again, ladies. It was so lovely to talk to you again.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you. Take care.